2012, March 9th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 44. This View of Life, the Astronomy 141 Course Summary. Well, today is the final lecture for this course. It is, of course, lecture number 44. We began this course on the 3rd of January, beginning to ask the question, are we alone? And how do we turn that question into an actual scientific question we can expect to find an answer to? And today, what I'd like to do in this lecture is, rather than talk about something completely new on the last day, to step back a little bit from where we began 10 weeks ago and ask where we are now today. How well have we gone about asking the question, are we alone? Is there life elsewhere in the universe? And how do we pose that question and try to understand that question as a scientific inquiry? It's always good to begin with a quote in these sort of overviews, and no one is more quotable than the famous 20th century physicist Albert Einstein. A lot of what he says is quotable enough to end up on t-shirts and ball caps. Usually this quote is shortened to the middle portion, imagination is more important than knowledge, which is kind of unfortunate because the context of the entire statement that he made is actually much more interesting. He said, I am enough of an artist to draw freely upon my imagination. Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited, but imagination circles the world. Einstein's point was that knowledge is what we learn after we ask questions. We pose the questions of the world and we try to get answers back. But imagination is what drives us to ask those questions in the first place. And if we look back over all of human history, we find that it is that human imagination, that is that asking of questions of the world, that always drives us forward. Science is but the most recent in human history, and in many ways the most powerful of the ways in which we've learned to ask questions of nature and interpret the answers that we receive back. It's a highly critical way of viewing the universe because it is a hallmark of a system of knowledge. The system of knowledge begin with, what are the facts we have? What are the observations? What are the data? What are the questions we're trying to ask? And then ask what conclusions we may draw from that. Other ways of viewing the world start with the conclusion and then look for the support. We're going to turn that upside down. That means that our conclusions are the ones, in fact, that are fluid. It is the facts that remain. And there's no more obvious fact of the human existence than when we look out at the nighttime sky and we see the sky filled with stars. This is sadly a fairly rare view to us here in the 21st century. We're living in a time when we have the greatest understanding of the universe, and yet we have the least view of that universe. Many of you, if we go outside in a typical urban setting, or even within a few hundred miles of where we live, we can probably count the number of stars we can see in our hands, and perhaps no more, because of the steady encroachment of bright lights upon the night sky. But certainly to our ancestors, this would be what the night sky would have been, a black velvet field filled with bright points of light. It is interesting to note that in some of the earliest products of the human imagination that we've been able to see survive from ancient times is a measurement of the heavens. We often think of the earliest artifacts of the human intelligence as these cave paintings, for example, like these 15,000-year-old paintings from the Lascaux Cave in France, or the older paintings that have been found so far in places like Chauvet-Pont-d'Arc. But in fact, there are early artifacts showing bone carvings, and one of these in particular is the Aubrey Blanchard bone. It's a reindeer bone which has been carved and streaked with a series of dots and crescents, which when tied together is a record of the phases of the moon. This is the first calendar, probably. It was a small carving in which whoever the early human being was who was making this carving was marking the passage of time by the passage of the phases of the moon, much as we to this day mark the passage of time against the months and the years and the seasons by following the motions of the sun across the sky, the phases of the moon through the night time. So it's very early that we see, with the dawning of what we come to view as one of those most human of attributes, the intellect, the intelligence of the human being, the ability to have abstract symbols and abstract representation, that we find that man is not only representing the world, but beginning perhaps in a very simple way to enumerate and count and measure the world, to ask what are the facts of the world around us that we see. We certainly know as we come forward and as civilization becomes more organized, we see that the use of the heavens, in fact, to set our timescales, our calendars, measurements of the world become far more common and become the basis of many of what we refer to as civilization. This is the oldest known depiction of the entire night sky. It's actually found on the roof of the inner chamber of a tomb, which is held by a high functionary of the 15th century BC. His name would have largely been forgotten had this tomb actually not survived to the modern day, but what we find upon it is even at this period now, more than 1,800 years ago, was a very fairly accurate depiction and layout of the nighttime sky, the awareness that the Earth is within a larger cosmos, and that that cosmos can not only be seen and perhaps interpreted metaphorically, but also can be mapped. It can be measured. It can be used as a point of reference. It seems to represent something of the eternal. So we move forward into the Renaissance. There were a series of intellectual revolutions that changed the way in which humankind looks at the world and ultimately at the universe around us. One of the most profound, certainly from the point of view of our place in the universe, was the revolution of Nicholas Copernicus. It was Copernicus who took the Earth away from this sort of semi-common sense view of the Earth being at the center of the universe and made it but one of many planets circling the sun. In doing so, in the hands of Kepler, was able to lead to a mathematical description of planetary motions that was to give birth to the modern world. But it also opened up the possibility of an infinite universe. Giordano Bruno is perhaps the most tragic example of those who realized right away what Thomas Diggs is showing in this beautiful woodcut from the same period as Bruno and Kepler, that Copernican universe, by taking the Earth from the center and placing it around the sun, makes the stars other suns and therefore opens up the possibility of an infinite universe. An infinite universe containing an infinity of suns, around each of those infinity of suns, perhaps an infinity of worlds, and perhaps even among those, an infinity of other living beings looking up at the sky and asking the same questions that we ask of it ourselves. But if these are philosophical abstractions, apparently, or mathematical abstractions, it was Galileo who gave us our clearest view of this by bringing into use a device he did not invent, but he applied, the telescope, to actually use as a tool for measuring the heavens. If Bruno and Kepler and Copernicus could imagine other worlds, it was Galileo who first showed them to us, who showed us that the moon had terrain, that Jupiter had moons circling it like our own moon circles the Earth and like we as an entire retinue of planets circle the sun. It allowed anyone who bothered to pick up this very simple piece of technology to see the sky for themselves and see that the heavens were far more than we could sense with the eyes that we were born with. It meant the heavens were vaster than our simple everyday human experience. And that was part of the evolution of human thought and understanding our place in the universe. Well, of course, I'm an astronomer, and so I always like to concentrate on looking outwards. But in a class like this, we have to also remember that in part what we learn is also was advanced by learning how to look inwards. Anton von Leeuwenhoek, in the generation just following Galileo, turned the telescope around, not on the heavens, but on the inner world of the things that were smaller than the human eye could see, and began to reveal the immense beauty and complex detail of all living things upon this planet. The microscope is to biology what the telescope is to astronomy. It gives us a view that goes beyond what the simple gifts of biology give to our frail human eyes and allows us to see what life is actually made like. Improvements in the microscope, like improvements in the telescope, led to tremendous advances into what the nature of life was. We also saw that as we began to explore both outer space with the telescope and inner space with the microscope, we began to change our view of what was matter. It wasn't simply the four elements of Aristotle, but in fact was far more complex, but in that complexity there was the deep seeds of order, that the atomic structure of matter, that the nature of chemical interactions were not simply random. They could be understood as revealing the deep order of the organization of the material world. And so we went from a world of alchemy, where one simply manipulated materials to find new materials without understanding why, to, out of that, a deeper understanding of the atomic world and the structure of matter on the smallest scales. We also turned the same light that we saw to matter on the smallest scales onto the Earth itself. We began to see the Earth not simply as a place where we are standing, but actually as a physical system. And as a physical system, it has a past, it has forces that work, and that one can read in that past the detailed history of our planet. We can see the different sediments layered one along the other, like multiple volumes in a book reading off the history of our world. And by seeing this, we saw that the Earth was, in fact, tremendously older than anyone had ever suspected, certainly older than human history itself. Before the discoveries of modern geology and astronomy, man was the measure of all things, including the lifetime of our civilization. It is not surprising that in the 16th and 17th century, mankind viewed the world as only as old as human civilization, as only about 6,000 years old. But as we began to learn more about how the world worked, both on the Earth and in space, we began to realize that human history is but a small fraction of the history of the universe that we find ourselves living in. There are places like this in our world. This is the Canadian Archean Shield up far north of here where we're standing today. These are the bones of the Earth. These are some of the oldest rocks upon our planet. They are a little altered over a history that spans more than 3.8 billion years. And even these are not the oldest rocks we can find upon our world. We find zircons that can get on the Earth to dating as early as 4.3 billion years from this day. Using methods of radioactive dating that we discussed in this class, we can measure them just the same way we read off a clock. We can find on various places on the Earth some of the oldest rocks, the best preserved places on our planet. And it is not surprising that in these places, which show basically the endpoints of the formation process of our planet, we can begin to read off the history of that world and learn a little bit about how it relates to the history of everything else on our planet. Life, too, has a history. It may not seem as immediately obvious, but certainly on a human time scale, we know of history. We know of the history of civilizations. But life has a history and a structure, and the basis of that history is heredity. We are related to those who came before us, and indeed there appear to be deep relationships among all things that live on this planet. Gregor Mendel, working with something as simple as peas, was able to work out the laws of genetics, the laws of heredity, without understanding at all the molecular basis of genetics. Sexual reproduction became understood at the beginning portion of the 20th century as an exchange of chromosomes and a mixing of systems that are passing on this long chain molecule called deoxyribonucleic acid. Within the DNA is basically coded all of the information necessary to build a living organism. It is the molecular basis of heredity. It is no longer mysterious and accidental. One does not have traits that are simply acquired. They are deeply written within the molecular basis of life itself. But understanding how you can go to from the molecular basis, or understanding the laws of heredity, one also has to understand that in life itself has a deep and detailed history that shows the interrelationships between all things. The primary advance in understanding those deep relationships came from one person in the 19th century, Charles Darwin, who lived in the early portion of the 19th century, and who in the year 1859 wrote a very small and humble and deeply misunderstood book called On the Origin of Species. What Darwin was to argue in this book was that using the mechanisms of heredity, which he did not understand at the molecular level, and which his ignorance shows deep inside this book, but nonetheless was able to piece together that in fact there is a mechanism by which one species can evolve from another without having to have any abrupt changes. Everything is related to everything else. Everything is a descendant of everything else in the past history of the world. This famous picture shows one of the insights that came out of On the Origin of Species. It is often incorrectly said to be the centerpiece of the book. In fact, it's only one small section. But in fact, it shows that among the finches of the Galapagos Island, that one can trace the lineages of evolution as different species emerged in response to pressures from their environment, the necessity of living to survive, to reproduce, and pass on those traits. If those traits give you even the slightest advantage in reproduction to be passed on to your offspring, that over time, the steady working of this process of natural selection will lead to, in fact, new and distinct species. It is but the natural version of what is done every day by farmers, animal husbandry experts through all of human history to bring forward species or bring forward varieties of animals that we have never seen before, plants or everything else. But it can occur in nature and occurs, and in fact, is the main way in which life develops on this planet. Do not misunderstand. Evolution does not talk about the origins of life. What evolution is about is the origin of life's diversity. It says, why do we see all the different forms that we do, and why are those forms deeply related? Not simply in their surface appearances, but as we've learned later, deep in their molecular structure, in the way in which they work at the chemical, physical, and molecular level, all life on this planet is closely interrelated. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. Proteins are the very fundamental pieces of the biochemical machinery of life on this planet. And yet every single form of life on this planet that we know of uses only 22 of the very large number of possible amino acids. Furthermore, it uses only the left-handed versions of those, never the right-handed. Right-handed amino acids only show up naturally in nature in roughly equal numbers, but in living things, only the left-hand ones matter. Only one of these amino acids, glycine, is not have a handedness because, in fact, it's neither left nor right-handed. There's only one form. It's the simplest of the amino acids, and it appears as one of the essential amino acids of life. Furthermore, we find other commonalities as we dig deeper into the biological machinery of life on this planet. We find that every form of life on this planet uses adenosine triphosphate as the primary means of converting chemical energy into useful forms for cellular metabolism. All of them. We know of many other catalytic reaction systems that can work within, potentially within living things using organic molecules. But why is it that only the ATP-ADP cycle is chosen by all living things on Earth? And that is another sign of the deep interrelationship. This is the way in which the ancient ancestor of all living things on this planet got its life, and it has been passed on through the genetic material that has gone to build all of the species we see today. Deoxyribonucleic acid, these long-chain double helix molecules, contain within them the detailed coding necessary to be able to put together every living organism. Every living organism on this planet uses DNA as the method of heredity. Everyone uses the same four base pairs, guanine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine. Nothing else. Every single one of those creatures uses RNA as the basic agent of cell machinery. It knows how to read the code from the DNA. It knows how to turn it into proteins. It knows how to tell them basically the cell and ultimately the organism how to function. So if DNA carries the instruction, RNA is what carries those instructions out. And ATP is the engine that keeps them running. And this is in every single living thing on this planet. Even though there are many other possible variations that could lead to the same basic effect, it's never been seen anywhere but these, which is telling us once again the deep interrelatedness of life. So interrelated is all of life that we can make something called the phylogenetic tree of life. Everything from the earliest forms of bacteria on our planet, the extremophiles that live only deep at deep ocean vents, to the bacteria, to the multicellular creatures of which we are one of the many branches upon this tree, are all deeply related. The history of life is written in DNA. We are only now beginning to really learn how to read that language, but as we've begun to see this, you see common words, if you will, genetic structures, which propagate their way through every living thing and only change very slowly. Just the same way that a philologist or a linguist can trace the appearances of words back through the language and the appearance in history and see the coming into contacts of different people. We can see the coming into contact of all the pieces of evolution driving this forward. So we've learned through a great deal of difficulty, we're only just starting to reach the point that we can read off the history of life on our planet. We can read off the history of our planet and the geology. And what has become surprising is in putting these two together that we can see that those two histories are deeply intertwined. And we talked about that in this class when we tried to link the history of the Earth and the history of life. We can see the Earth beginning in the Hadean Aeon, forming out of the raw material that the Sun and all the other planets formed out of. Initially, the Earth was lifeless, without an atmosphere, without liquid water. It was constantly being bombarded from outside by asteroids and comets. But over time, its gravity grew to the point that it could retain an atmosphere. The atmosphere built, and we happened to be in just the right spot with respect to the radiation from the Sun keeping the surface of our planet warm. Not so warm that water vaporized, and not so cold that water froze, but water could form into stable liquid water. And so by the end of the Hadean Aeon, by the time that the epoch of heavy bombardment had ended, and the Earth wasn't constantly getting pummeled by massive asteroidal impacts, which were capable of sterilizing its surface and turning its oceans into vast atmospheres of steam, the Earth settled down and quickly formed the appearance of liquid water across the liquids, the solid surface of our world. Very shortly after that period of stabilization, in the early portion of the Archean Eon, 3.8 billion years ago, the first living things began to emerge, the so-called stromatolites. I have a fossil stromatolite in my personal collection. It is nearly indistinguishable from modern stromatolites that we see in places like Shark's Bay, Australia. It's very interesting and sometimes very humbling to hold a small fossil remnant that you realize 3.8 billion years ago was actually a living thing. The fossil record is woefully incomplete. We would like to see a more complete record, but even that incomplete record is sufficient to put together all of the history of the world. But the Earth is not static, and the Earth was putting, even though the epoch of heavy bombardment, the possibility of massive planetary sterilization had ended, there were still challenges that were imposed upon the Earth. We know of at least two times in the history of the Earth that the entire planet froze solid over through periods known as Snowball Earth. It recovered from those periods because we live on a geologically active world where the atmosphere is constantly being cycled through a cycle of volcanoes spewing out carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide and water vapor scrubbing that carbon dioxide out into the oceans and setting up a cycle in which our atmosphere is very straightforwardly regulated both in terms of temperature and in terms of chemical content. At various times, that chemical content has varied by dramatic amounts, increases of volcanism or snowball earth periods, tipping you slightly out of the balance, but the balance has always retained itself. And life has always managed, after its initial appearance, to keep itself going through these places, even if the extinction events may have wiped out most of the species that emerged. We certainly see going back about 2 billion years and one forward into 1 billion years into the past, the emergence of ever complex forms of life. The cyanobacteria here, quite modest, they form long, large colonies. These colonies are important because these are photosynthetic. They can take the carbon dioxide and sunlight and water, and they can turn it into oxygen and sugars. They use the sugars to live, and they expel the oxygen as a waste product. Once the mineral sinks of oxygen filled up on our planet, oxygen began to grow in the Earth's atmosphere. Life began to sprout on the Earth in far more complex forms because oxidation chemistry provides a very powerful system of chemical metabolism, allowing, with greater energy, more and more complex forms of life. Until just before about 600 million years ago, we see the first few echoes of really complex multicellular life turning from simple cellular systems, which were probably evolved from early colonies of simple single eukaryotes, into things that are actually recognizable as animals, but not in any kind of animal life we recognize today. 600 million years ago, or more precisely 545 million years ago, at the beginning of the Cambrian, at the beginning of what we call the Phanerozoic Eon, the age of the rule of life upon Earth, all of that changed. It's so dramatic in the fossil record, it is called the Cambrian Explosion. Every single body plan for all the organisms that we find on this planet, plants, animals, anything that's above the single cellular level, appeared during the Cambrian Explosion. Of the 14 or 15 body plans, only a handful survive. But among them are important ones, like Pikea gracilens, is an early chordate, the distant ancestor of everything on this planet that now has a spine. The trilobites, which can be recognized in certain types of insects. Whenever you see a pill bug, for example, working out in your garden, you're seeing the distant descendant of an ancient trilobite that wandered through the oceans of the Cambrian period. Sponges, worms, all of those basic body plans emerged during the Cambrian explosion. And since then, no brand new body plans have emerged on this planet. So this is the real burst of animal and plant life upon our world. Within a relatively short time after this, as the oxygen level increased in our atmosphere, the Earth slowly but surely built up a shield of ozone in the upper atmosphere, making it possible for creatures to leave the oceans where they had been living for billions of years and colonize the land. Land colonization went on very rapidly on a geological timescale, over tens of millions of years, whereas before, billions of years were spent in the oceans. By the time of the Carbonaceous period, vast forests covered the land areas of the Earth, and the first few simple animals and insects began their emergence onto the land. The plants went first, The animals followed a couple 10, 20 million years after that initial colonization. We can see the effects of the carbonaceous forest that we see in this computer reconstruction of what the carbonaceous forest probably looked like some 300 million years ago. We use it every day when we use coal power. The coal fields that we now mine in West Virginia and China and elsewhere to derive the electricity for much of the world, in fact, is the dead, decaying plant matter of carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere, locked up in living matter and eventually decayed and pressed into rock through geologic activity over 300 million years. Over time, two major animal groups, emerged into the world of these forests, the dinosaurs and the mammals. The dinosaurs got the upper hand. And certainly this particular fanciful painting shows you a typical scene during the Triassic period where multiple sauropods and theropods are living out their lives, are the principal species upon this planet, and only working very small, and this picture unseen, in between the cracks were the mammals, the small, hairy creatures that ultimately were to be our ancestors. But at this time, this is the world of the dinosaurs. And the dinosaurs were remarkably successful. From a period of nearly 200 million years ago until 65 million years ago, they were the dominant species upon this planet. That all ended 65 million years ago in a cataclysmic event that occurred that marks the end of the Cretaceous and the beginning of the Tertiary period, where there's a vast layer of iridium filling all around the Earth, this tiny thin layer. Before that is the time of the dinosaurs, and after that is the time of the mammals. A massive asteroid made an impact on the Earth near where the Caribbean Basin is, out near the present-day Yucatan Peninsula, hitting with sufficient force that it didn't matter whether it hit at land or ocean. In fact, it actually hit in the ocean off the coast there. It was not a land impact. It destroyed and caused the extinction of most of the marine species and most of the large land species. It cleared the dinosaurs out of the way and made room for the furballs. The furballs could now radiate into the ecological niches that were opened up when the ecosystem of the Earth was turned upside down by the Chicxulub Basin impactor. And in the forests of the Tertiary period that followed, it was the mammals that were now the principal form of life on the surface of the Earth. We see even in these ancient forms, recognizable forms, that now evolve into the species that we see surrounding us today. And we've remained, up to the present day, the dominant form of life. One particular species has managed a rather unique trick. Its intelligence grew to the point that it began to learn how to use tools to magnify the gifts of biology well beyond what the gifts of evolution would possibly drive, and move into a parallel form of evolution we call cultural evolution. We were able to pass knowledge on through symbolic language, through poetry, through metaphor, through religion. There are many ways in which we have built up series and ways of knowing the world, and it has brought us to the point that going from furballs living in between the cracks of the dinosaurs, there are now 7 billion of us, the dominant species on this planet. And yet that species has done something which no other that we know of has done before, and that is to look back upon itself and ask, why are we here? What is our place that we live? It's the same inquiry that we've done for the last 10 weeks here. We've asked the question, what is our place in the universe? What is the meaning? What is life? Is there life elsewhere, and how would we find it? This is our world. This is the Earth. It's mostly a water planet, a thin atmosphere containing mostly nitrogen and a bit of oxygen. It is the harbor of life. In fact, it is the only harbor of life that we know of in the entire universe. It is a green and blue water world. But are there other places where life might have emerged in the past or where may actually be emerging in the present? We don't know the answer to that, but we know some places we could look. For a long time, we thought the place that we would be most likely to find life in our own solar system is a nearby neighbor, Mars. Quite a bit smaller than the Earth and a bit further away, Mars turns out not to be a living world. It is, in fact, a cold, dry desert world. It is nearly frozen. What liquid water is on its surface is no longer stable. It is now frozen into the subsurface and into the poles and no longer exists in liquid form. It is a heavily cratered world with a terribly thin carbon dioxide atmosphere. And yet it is still a world with plenty of water. We have gone there. We've sent a number of probes down to the surface. We have dug into its soil. We have seen water ice just below the surface sublimating away in the sunshine with the Mars Phoenix lander, for example, that landed near the northern pole of the planet. We have sent rovers that are wandering about the surface of the planet with geological and chemical experiments, looking at the nature of the mineralogy of the planet, and we are sending a new spacecraft that just launched out earlier this year in November and will be on its way to land in August on the surface of Mars, a very large rover about the size of a Mini Cooper that carries with it an advanced geological laboratory and the ability to search for at least some of the signs of organic chemical processes. Mostly it's looking for water and organics. We don't yet have any sign that life exists on Mars now, but we do in fact know that in the Mars past, there was substantial amounts of liquid water. We have mapped the surface of Mars as well as we had mapped our own planet 20 years ago by this point. We now know where every crook and valley, every gully, and a handful of places have appeared where we actually see not simply catastrophic flows of water, but long-term sustained flows of water. The Ebersvalde Delta, as it's called, is basically an ancient dry river delta zone. It shows the meandering streams and flow patterns that look eerily like what we would see if you were to take the Mississippi Delta Basin and drain it of water. So Mars, at some point in its past, probably did have liquid water. Its atmosphere was heavier. Its temperatures were warm enough to sustain stable liquid water. We don't know what Mars would have looked like filled with water. This is a fanciful view. Actually, this is Mars today turned into a water and blue and green world. Perhaps Mars in its past, perhaps the first billion years of its history, may have been an abode for life. We know that on our own planet, as soon as the planet stabilized and was free of sterilization, that life arose very, very rapidly, within less than 100 million years of the stabilization of the oceans. Could that same thing have happened on Mars? Mars may have been warm enough to be an abode of liquid water during the first billion years of its existence. We don't know. There are lots of arguments of that, but a major program, not only of NASA, but the European Space Agency, that will play out over many decades, certainly through my life and yours, will be aimed at trying to answer that question. Perhaps there are fossil bacteria on Mars, just like there are fossil bacteria upon the Earth, or maybe, just maybe, even though the surface is inhospitable to life, maybe something is still living, if perhaps microbiologically, underneath the surface of the planet. We know that life can live in extreme environments upon our planet. They can live even in rock many miles below the Earth. So certainly there are possibilities. We don't know the answers, but that hasn't stopped us from looking because we're always curious to know what that answer is. There are other places in the solar system that have also been surprises. We've discovered that around Jupiter's moon Europa, the simple fresh ice caps of the outer surface of the planet are virtually free of craters, telling us it's a geologically young surface. And beneath that, there are the indications of a vast liquid water ocean. The planet is kept warm not by the sunlight, it's too far from the sun, but by the tidal squeezing and pulling from the planet Jupiter and surrounding moons that actually tidally heats the interior and warms it to the point that liquid water may be present. We're starting to develop technologies of how one might drill through the ices of Europa and release a probe, an actual little astro submarine, to be able to search the seas of Europa for the possible signs of life. We're going to try out those technologies in the deep glacial lakes of the Antarctic, places where there is liquid water trapped below miles of Antarctic ice that have not been exposed to the surface for more than 20 million years. What surprises lie beneath Lake Vostok and the others? We don't know. We've penetrated into the waters of Lake Vostok for the first time during this class. Maybe in future times when I teach this to other classes, we'll be talking about whatever it is they find down underneath the ices of the Antarctic. And maybe it will be you or perhaps one of your children who may be lecturing a room like this about what we found beneath the ices of Europa. We even found a surprise among the children of Saturn, the tiny moon Enceladus, white, fresh, pristine surface with very few craters. When it was imaged with the Cassini spacecraft looking back towards the sun, it discovered there were these vast fountains of water ice coming out of cracks in the deep surface. It's actually been repurposed and retargeted using the limited fuel available on the spacecraft to fly it through these probes, these plumes. When Cassini flew through the plumes of the fountains of Enceladus, it found salty water. It saw the beginnings of small carbon compounds, possibly leading to the presence of organic compounds. There is a liquid water, if not an ocean like on Europa, but certainly deep pockets of liquid standing water deep beneath the ices of Enceladus. Could this be another place where stable liquid water and a combination of heat, again, tidal heating, from the surrounding moons with a little bit of radioactivity to help it out? Could this be another place where life might have gotten a foothold within our own solar system? We find other worlds even stranger. The giant moon Titan of Saturn, the other of the two children of Saturn that we considered, is not a place of liquid water. It's too cold and too harsh, but it does have an atmosphere of nitrogen and a little bit of methane, and into the cold of the Titanian atmosphere, methane acts like water does on the Earth. We see a hydrological cycle or a methanological cycle of condensation, evaporation, and precipitation. It's so complex that we even see lakes as big as Lake Superior on the surface of Titan, filled not with liquid water, but with liquid methane and liquid ethane. This is a truly prebiotic world. It has a chemistry which is related to the Earth's, but it is based on liquid methane, not on liquid water. Again, what surprises lie in wait for us beneath the clouds of Titan? What is actually there? Are these simply sterile seas, or is there actually something there? Is there complex chemistry? Are there catalytic chemistry that can go on in these cold seas that we haven't even begun to imagine? People are beginning to work on this in the laboratory and ask, what chemistry can go on in a liquid methane environment? And someday we're hopefully going to send probes, perhaps balloons, perhaps gliders, to fly around this world. We've already landed on the surface and gotten our first taste of one of the most alien places we've ever been. And yet that alien place is our own solar system. It is part of our own backyard. If we go beyond our solar system, we look out to the stars surrounding us, to the solar neighborhood, to the stars within 30 or 40 light years surrounding us. And we look to those stars and say, how many of those are suns like our own? How many of them have planets? The search has begun for planets around other stars. We've been looking for decades. And beginning 20 years ago, we found the first system beyond our own solar system. When I began in school, there was only one solar system, our own. Today, on the 9th of March, there are 760 planets known around more than 600 other suns. We have vastly increased in an explosive way the number of known plausible worlds around other stars. We've actually begun to get the technology to the point that we've begun to take pictures of these planets. We're not simply finding them by the Doppler techniques or the interruption of the light of the background star when they pass between us and their host star. A few of these now are only be able to see very distant, very giant planets, but this image of the beautiful system HR 8799 has four worlds on recognizable relatively circular orbits. And all of these are giant Jupiter-sized planets, but we ask the question, well, what's lying closer, deeper in towards these stars? The Kepler space probe, through the course of this class, since we started in January, Kepler every week has been adding to our roster of known planetary systems. At the beginning of December, it had added to the system of known planets a sun-like star, slightly cooler than our own, called Kepler 11, has six planets, most of them gas giants, and a couple of them are so-called super-Earths, orbiting around the central star. We found even stranger worlds, like Kepler 16, in which a very large planet is orbiting, or in this case a gas giant planet, is orbiting around a distant binary star companion, something that used to be predicted by science fiction, a staple of movies like Star Wars, has in fact been found to be part of nature itself. And we're beginning to close in on the thing we would really like to find, and those are Earths. We would like to find an Earth in the habitable zone. The very first of these systems, Kepler 22b, it's not exactly what we were looking for. It's a super-Earth, which is inside the generous inner limit of the Kepler 22 habitable zone. Is it habitable? Does it have liquid water? Probably not. But we're getting close. I used to think I would never see the discovery of an Earth inside of its Earth-sized planet inside the habitable zone of its star in my own lifetime. I'm willing to actually almost go to the point of actually taking bets that I will learn about the existence of such a thing, if not this year, then probably next. We have a technology which is increased by leaps and bounds to enhance our ability to find these worlds, and we are not there yet, but a day is coming very soon when we will find not one but many Earth-sized planets residing in their habitable zones. In the habitable zone of a star, water can be stable. If the planet has an atmosphere, if the planet has a stable tectonics, if it is capable of sustaining liquid water, then perhaps it might be an abode of life. But we don't just simply have to speculate about this. By studying life on our own world and studying the history of life on our own world, we have learned that there are signatures in the spectrum of these worlds that will give away the presence of life even if we don't see a single plant or cow. We can see whether there's oxygen in the atmosphere, which is a signpost of photosynthesis. We can see whether there's liquid water, which has a different spectral signature and specular signature than water in the vapor form. We can see whether it even has an atmosphere. Some of these may be dead rocks, but some of them will show the carbon dioxide and water and oxygen of an atmosphere. And if we find all of those pieces, perhaps we're going to find the signposts of life. It may be a trace of methane. It may be a chlorophyll-type red edge in the overall reflection spectrum of the planet. But one of these days, and I think it probably not too soon, it may not happen in my lifetime, but I think it will probably happen in yours or your children's, we will find a world circling a star nearby that not only is an Earth in its habitable zone, but it shows the unmistakable signs of biological processes on its surface. But we're not waiting for that time in the future. We'd like to know if life exists elsewhere in the universe. And maybe if not so much life, photosynthetic life is interesting, but intelligent life would be even more interesting. So in addition to the parallel search for the possible places where life may arise, there is another search going on, listening into the depths of space to see if we can hear the faint whispers of another technologically advanced civilization. Called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is listening to as many stars looking for a signal that cannot be artificial, that cannot be natural, but in fact is artificial, is made by another intelligence transmitting its presence to the world. What do we expect? Well, perhaps something like the Arecibo message that we ourselves sent out to the heavens, a simple stream of ones and zeros that when reassembled on the basis of a ratios of products of prime numbers, recognizable to any advanced civilization with knowledge of basic mathematics and electromagnetic radiation, could piece together a simple pictogram that can tell us where it is we come from, what we are made of, and perhaps even a little bit, even just a hint, of what we look like. When we receive such a message, what would it contain? We don't know. But we have some ideas of what it might look like as we can imagine what we ourselves would send. But we haven't stopped with simply sending electromagnetic signals into space. We've always been a species that has liked to make its presence known, sort of write their name on the wall to say, we are here. In addition to sending out radio signals, we have sent physical artifacts describing our world and our place within the Milky Way galaxy on the Pioneer 10 and the Voyager spacecraft that are launched in the 1970s, before most of you were born, and actually now on their way out of our solar system. Voyager 1 is within a few 100 million miles of actually leaving the solar system and entering interstellar space. The other three, Pioneer 10 and 11 and Voyager 2, are on their way immediately behind it. And on top of them are human artifacts describing ourselves and our world. This is something very recognizably human about us. One of the oldest pieces of artifacts from early humans is from Chauvet Pont d'Arc Cave, 32,000 years ago. In that cave, was a human being who put his hand up and sprayed red ochre around the outside to leave their handprint. An ancient graffiti, a way of saying, I was here. I'm man. We've always left our mark upon the world, for better or worse, and we're now trying to say to other people, we are here. We are intelligent. We want to know what this world is like. One of these days, we may in fact discover one of these Earths around there. If we do find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of its star, and we do detect the spectroscopic signatures of life, the desire to go there will be simply overwhelming. Whether we have the technological means to do so is a different question. But I believe, in fact, that this discovery would probably unite humanity in trying to answer that question, because our curiosity has always driven us forward. It is our imagination. We can think what it must look like, but we overwhelmingly desire to see it for ourselves. And perhaps even someday that may carry us not only beyond our world, but on the worlds beyond, into the stars that make up our entire galaxy. All 200 billion of them are possible places for us to go, if only we have the will and are driven by our curiosity. This is the Earth as seen from afar. This was a picture taken by the Cassini spacecraft looking between the rings of Saturn. It looks back upon our Earth and sees what Carl Sagan so poetically referred to as a pale blue dot, lost in the blackness of space. Everything we've ever known, all of human history, has been played out on that few small handfuls of pixels. This is the place where we come from. And yet the reason why we explore and the reason we ask these questions is buried deep within what makes us human. To quote from T.S. Eliot's fourth and final poem from the Four Quartets, Little Gidding, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring we will be to arrive at the place we started and to know that place for the first time. We ask the questions of whether there is life on other worlds and what other places may be like, because ultimately we are driven by a desire to, in the end, to know ourselves. We've learned much about this world, and we have so much more to learn." Over the last few weeks, it has been a great privilege to show you what we have learned over these years and how we can actually turn the question of, is there life into the universe, into a scientific inquiry. I thank you for listening, and thank you for the quarter. See you all on Tuesday. Thank you.